Podcasts of Homegrown are made possible thanks to support from listeners like you. Consider becoming a member of WFPL by calling 502-814-6565 or at the website wfpl.org. Thanks. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
I remain Bob Hill.
And today on the show...
Highs and lows.
Highs and lows.
Literally.
Indeed. Roger Gosler's joining us. He's part of a trio, a family trio, that has written a book, The Gosler Guide to the Best Hardy Shrubs.
Yeah, I was out there 8 or 10 or 12 years ago. Who remembers anymore? And it may have planted the seed for Hidden Hill because it's a fascinating place. He's got 4 acres of plants he brought home from all over the world.
And where's out there?
You know, Springfield, Oregon.
Okay.
Good question. And he's got like 5,000 or 6,000 plants on this 4 acres, either for sale or growing. And he travels the world looking for new plants. And he's going to talk about shrubs, the best hardy shrubs, most of which actually I've seen around here and will do just fine.
Yeah, good.
So
it's a new, it's a nice reference book, quite frankly.
Yes.
And categorized in a different sort of way. Like if you want the old standbys or you want something new and exciting, he's addressed it in that way. So that's a little bit different.
Even beyond that, he's got shrubs for exceptional foliage, shrubs for deep shade, shrubs for full sun, fragrant shrubs. So you can look at the back of the book.
And get exactly what
right away, you know, what you can do and not do.
Yeah, exactly.
Shrubs can't read, so they need all the help they can get.
That's right. We're looking forward to that, Roger Gosler. And then Josephine Hedger. I'm really excited about this because after the ice storm last year, we had arborists come out, and they were areas where you can't use a bucket truck, so they had to have expertise. I mean, like profound proficiency. Yeah, how's that?
Without a net.
In climbing
too.
Trees.
That's the heck of it, yeah.
And the guys from Limewalker came out, and I literally just stood there with my mouth wide open. Georgie, my niece, called them the squirrel men because Bob, these are like 75-foot trees, and then there's Corey teetering in the top of it with a chainsaw, taking out hanging limbs from the ice storm.
Yeah, I've seen them
and
work.
It's just amazing. So anyway, Josephine Hedger, she's from England, and she's an arborist and champion tree climber. This is the stuff they do every day, right, for their jobs, but then they also have these championships and competitions, you know, locally, nationwide, internationally, that sort of thing. So she's in town heading to a competition, and we get to talk to her. And, you know, it's kind of unique, too, because she's a woman, and this particular field does not have loads of women in it.
No.
So we're going to find out what it takes to be a tree climbing arborist expert. So,
gravity-defying, chainsaw-carrying, limb-whacking tree climber.
And Josephine actually holds a world record. Can you get up a tree 35 feet up a tree in 15 seconds?
With a bucket truck.
Yeah, exactly. With an elevator.
No other way.
Well, Josephine can, and we're going to find out a little bit more about her experiences. So looking forward to that. Bob, what's going on in your garden?
First thing, I cannot remember a spring where everything popped out at once.
It's amazing.
Incredible. I kind of regret it in a sense because it was so lovely, and then it's gone.
Mm-hmm.
And you wish it kind of extended.
But boy, did we need it this year, didn't we?
It was fabulous. Yeah.
Yeah.
So along with them came some pests, I think. One thing, I've got aphids I've never had before. You
already?
Have a problem? Yeah.
Not quite yet, but usually once it warms up, they can really reproduce quickly.
Yeah, they certainly do. Mm-hmm. And I'm neeming them.
Are you?
Among other things, and it seems to be working, and that's fine. But the other thing I did, I'm so proud of, I imiclopredded my ash tree.
Did you? Good.
Yeah. It was, we talked about the ash tree and the borer and the problems, and it costs like $20 to get a bottle of stuff, and you pour it around the base of your ash tree.
Okay. Mix it in a watering can.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Uh-huh. Mix it up, and I followed directions.
Good.
It's well worth it. So just the time of year when you want to start looking for bugs and then do something
about
it.
And be responsibly proactive, right?
How about the wishy state? What's up?
Well, a woman had sent me a question a couple of weeks ago. Mm-hmm. She has chickens, and she was wondering if I had any ideas about her designing and creating a garden for her flock.
Oh, my goodness.
You know, so like plants that they might like, that they might enjoy.
I can see a speed museum thing here. Chickens wandering around in the anteroom.
In the garden.
Yeah.
So I was thinking about it, and it occurred to me when you watch the chickens, as they move around my gardens in different places, they don't really want a garden. What they want, they love grass.
Yeah, they want food.
They want, they don't necessarily want to eat your plants as much as you think, but they love grass. They love creating a garden that might attract insects they like, and they like scratching around in your garden.
Yeah.
So it's not that we can really create it, but it's just, it's like almost the thing that they love the most is grass.
And I'm dying to hear your answer to this question because this is interesting. Grass.
Yeah. And which is weird, isn't it?
No.
It's like, quite frankly,
not for chickens.
Letting them run around in the grass is what would make them the happiest.
What makes me happy when I'm a kid.
They run around and they chase bugs and it's just so funny. Anyway, another part of the chicken story too. I have this terribly, terribly broody hen right now.
Oh, no.
We thought she was sick.
Uh-oh.
But there's some straw in this old trailer, small little trailer that you would pull behind like a riding mower or something. And that's where I keep my extra straw. And they like to lay their eggs in there. So she's been sitting in the same place for days. So we thought she was sick. So I tried to go pick her up and she nearly attacked me. So I have to wait until they all roost, till it's dark enough to where she's sedate enough, and pick her up and put her inside, the secure part of the coop. Otherwise, she would just sit there on an egg that is not going to hatch because I don't have any roosters.
That's where the expression brood hen came
exactly.
from.
Exactly. She brooding. Wants to sit on her brood.
She's brooding.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But boy, is she pissed off.
What did you do to her?
Nothing. It's just instinct. You can't. Oh. That's the thing. You cannot change the instinct of an animal,
chicken
right?
Chicken counseling.
That's right. Yeah. They want to run around free and flap their wings and eat grass.
Yeah.
And from time to time, they're going to get broody.
Don't we all?
No matter what you do.
Sounds like
so we're just going to leave her to it.
Yeah. Well, good going.
All right.
Dr. Wishy solves the problem. Yeah. For more information on solving chicken problems.
Yeah, I don't know about that.
Call Janine.
I just kind of leave.
1-800-CHICKEN.
Let nature do its thing, I suppose, is the best answer. All right. If you're not really sure about what to do and you've got land and other things, here's a really cool thing that's going on. And this is somebody who Bob and I really like. She's retired now, but Pat Lahr was with the Scott County Soil and Water Conservation District for many, many years, right? So now she's going to embark on doing these workshops. And I think they're like Chicks on the Farm, basically, presented by Pat and some other folks. And it's also in partnership with Plant a Tree for You and Me, which is one of the programs there. But it's in Nab, Indiana, and it's a workshop for women landowners. So you can sign up, and it's an all-day-long thing and lunch. They're going to talk about like creating wetlands for wildlife, bird watching and identification, all kinds of different things that will help you improve your land for nature, but also so you can have some fun with it, too. And they're very knowledgeable. So I think it's a great idea. So if you're interested, a workshop for women landowners, check it out. We'll put more information on our website at WFPL.org.
Plus, you get to visit Nab, Indiana.
Mm-hmm.
That in itself is a treat.
It's pretty out there.
Doesn't take long.
It doesn't take long. It doesn't take long. So, Bob, on to the best hardy shrubs.
Yeah, speaking of good things, and I certainly love my shrubs, and don't we all? We've got the perfect guest. He's Roger Gosler. He's part of a family nursery. He's been in business near Springfield, Oregon for more than 40 years. He's traveled the country and the world seeking unusual specimens, many of which are now part of his almost 6,000 plants growing in the nursery. He's with us today to talk about his new book, The Gosler Guide to the Best Hardy Shrubs, More Than 350 Expert Choices for Your Garden, which was written by Roger, his brother Eric, and his mom, Marjorie. Roger, welcome to Homegrown.
Thanks. Nice to be on with you.
Give us some background about the family nursery, the history and the size and how this all got started.
Well, we started, the family's been here since about 1914 in this neighborhood. And in the 50s and 60s, we were doing sweet corn and peppermint for canned corn and Wrigley's gum. And then my parents got interested in the plants through the 50s and 60s and it just sort of developed. We started buying more and more plants and where to get the money to pay for them. So we started the nursery to help pay for the habit.
And then you started making trips around the country and the world to feed that habit, right?
Yes, definitely.
Where did you go? Tell us about some of your journeys.
Well, we've been to Europe about four different times looking at different gardens of some pretty incredible things. In Western Europe, and then a lot in the Northeast, and then the sort of Mid Atlantic states, and then a wonderful trip to Louisville about 8 or 9 years ago.
Oh yeah. What are some of the incredible things you saw?
Just enormous variety of plants that were not available here at the time. They're slowly getting available more and more, but when we first saw a lot of these things, like the for instance, the Cornus controversa variegata, the wedding cake dogwood.
Right.
We saw it in several places in England and France, and we had not seen it here at all yet. And so it pushed us to go find it in Holland and then bring it in, and we've had it available ever since.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, in your book, The Gosler Guide to the Best Hardy Shrubs, 350 choices, written by you and your brother and your mom. How in the world did you pull that one off?
Just, they came to us and asked us to do it.
Yeah. Was it hard to collaborate with 300?
It was. We did different parts of the book. Mine was my part were the descriptions of the plants and deciding what plants to put in there. Mm-hmm. And then Eric and Mother's were more the describing how we came about with these choices and our influences and why we chose what we chose.
Mm-hmm. And you got covered the technical side of it.
Right.
So, and one of the things that Bob and I were talking about that we liked so much, the different approach is the category of how you're presenting these plants.
Mm-hmm.
So can you talk a little bit about how you aim to direct people in deciding on what the best shrubs are for their landscapes?
Well, we it was a way to sort of define what we're doing. We decided that we did not want to have the newest, hottest, best plants that were untested. We wanted plants that had been around in gardens throughout the United States for a fairly good amount of time. I mean, we have a few, like say Calycanthus hartleaf wine, that's a fairly new plant.
Right.
But in general, these things have been around for quite a few years, and we chose them for being the best quality of disease-resistant, hardy within whatever zone you're wanting.
Yeah, in fact, you mentioned in your book specifically, because a lot of people think, oh, heck, he's in Oregon. They don't have any kind of variations in climate. But you've been through 18 below zero and mm-hmm. drought and rain and everything else that we get here.
Right. It does it sort of a different time. This year has been very mild, other than about a week in early December. It went down to 10 degrees
mm-hmm.
for a week, and that eliminated a lot of South African and Australian natives.
Mm-hmm. Right. But to go back to the categories, you break it down to old war horses, standards, the new kids on the block, just plain fun, tender mercies, which means kind of pushing the envelope, try mm-hmm. some Zone 7 plants and Zone 6, and then oddities.
Mm-hmm.
And then how not to kill these plants, cultivation tips. So give us some just broad tips on keeping these things alive.
Well, the biggest thing is that most of them need good drainage and select the best plant for that site of whether it's sun or shade and the size, that kind of thing. There, we offer a lot of different plants in the book, a lot of different suggestions of anything from ground covers to very large shrubs. And it's best to grow things that are suited for the area. And so even with our Zone 8 climate, 7 to 8 climate, we try to grow things that are hardy here probably 95 to 98% of the time.
Right.
We still grow some, like the tender mercies. We grow some things that are very tender, and we know we'll lose them every once in a while.
But it's worth
having them at during certain times.
Right.
Yeah, and you've got thousands of plants on your 4 acres, and something else you wrote about was if they die, it's their problem. You know.
Right.
It's opportunity.
It's not mine. Uh-huh. Yeah.
Yes.
For
yes.
something else.
For something else.
It's like we write about the Rodinner and the freeze of 12 below zero in 1972, and it was the best thing that ever could have happened to us, because we were deep into species rhododendrons, and it eliminated more than half of them in about a week, and it let us look at other plants and get a much more diverse palette of plants, so that we weren't depending if there's some horrible scourge of Phytophthora or whatever. We didn't lose everything again.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
So, Roger, can you talk about some, you know, I know it's an A to Z sort of guide, so there's lots of plants to talk about, but can you highlight some of your favorites that you would really like to see out there more and more?
One of the ones that I really like is the Dizanthus.
Uh-huh.
It's a redbud-looking plant, but it's a member of the witch hazel family.
Right.
And it's a dark green foliage all summer, and then in about September to October, it starts changing to a sort of a plum purple overcast on the leaves. And then by about mid to late October, early November, it'll turn to brilliant red, orange, and yellow fall color for a fairly extended season. And it's a moderate 10 to 12 foot shrub.
Mm-hmm.
I've got one hidden away in my shade area, and it does pretty well in there.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, I've got it in the picture of it in the book right now. And yeah, it kind of has that witch hazel appeal to it,
mm-hmm.
but an entirely different sort of color.
But again, that's a plant that's been around the Portland area, Oregon mm-hmm. area, for probably 60 to 70 years. It was brought in, it was grown in a few select gardens, but for whatever reason, it never got out to the gardening public, and we discovered it probably 30, 35 years ago, started growing it, and then it's other people have done it by tissue culture. So here, you're starting to see it in general line nurseries.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, a couple of the sea plants, the Calicarpa and the Clethra. Talk mm-hmm. about those a little bit.
The Calicarpa is the beauty berry.
Right.
And you probably can grow the Dictotoma and some of the other ones from the East Coast.
Yeah, we do.
We don't get the summer heat and humidity, and so we can only grow the Calicarpa profusion, which is a Japanese or Chinese native.
Right.
And but incredible purple fruit in the fall, and for us, with the most winters, they go on until January, February of these brilliant shiny little purple fruit. And then the Clethra are native. Most of them are native to the Southeast U.S. But one of the ones we talk about is Clethra barbinervis, that's a Japanese or Chinese species that makes a beautiful trunk on it of this peeling bark and about a 15-foot shrub or small tree.
Yeah, another one blooming just right now here is the Fotigilla, which has kind of taken off in interest, too.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's another one that when we first started growing it 35, 40 years ago, we had to bring them in from Holland. Mm-hmm. You know, it's an American native from Southeast U.S., and they're all strictly American natives, but they were not available in this country at all. And so we would have to buy them from Holland, grow them for a year, and then we'd sell most of them back to North and South Carolina, where it's native.
Mm-hmm.
That's a round licorice bud, smelling bud with a beautiful fall color, so people
right.
know what it is.
So I think that these plants, you know, that it's paid off because they are, you know, more commonplace.
Mm-hmm.
Curious about those that haven't quite had enough time to totally pay off still. Are there other shrubs
well,
that you might recommend?
Well, there's a lot of things that have been around a long time but mm-hmm. haven't caught the public's eye. One of the ones that's been incredible this year are the flowering quince, the Canomales.
Uh-huh. Mm-hmm.
We see them, the old species, Canomales japonica, out in old farmsteads and old gardens around the area. But there's a whole series of them that are much lower, more like 3 to 4 foot shrubs. They are thorny, which is a problem to some people, but we find that that's not a real problem in the garden,
mm-hmm.
but many of them have brilliant orange, red, pink flowers in the early spring and just massive amounts of flowers, and then yellow fruit in the late summer into the fall.
Mm-hmm. Alyssium?
Mm-hmm.
Anastatum?
Mm-hmm.
I've never heard of that.
That's the Anna shrub, and it's a Japanese native,
mm-hmm.
and we have Alyssium floridanum, and Harviflorum, I believe, is also an American native, that are from the Southeast, that are very good plants in the all over different parts of the country, and the Anastatum is probably a little too tender for your area,
mm-hmm.
but it's a beautiful white, ivory white flower of sort of like a star magnolia. They're small.
That's what I was thinking.
About an inch and a half wide flowers, and then there are sort of ivory white. And then the foliage smells of anise.
Mm, okay.
Another, I guess, in the old war horses, you have the Rosa rugosa, which I think Janine grows, the old-fashioned
mm-hmm.
rugosa rose that's just not used enough. It's just tough as nails and got
it's
a lot to go.
It's an incredible plant, but for us, we live on an island in a river, and it is so happy, it will romp. It will just run. But if you have clay kind of soil, it's a wonderful plant because you don't have to do any fungicides or pesticides or anything on it. It's totally clean of insects, beautiful waxy foliage and dark green foliage, and then really pretty pink to white flowers, and then great hips in the fall.
It does have great hips, and I actually got some young students who were visiting my farm one time to actually take a bite and taste them.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, and it was, yeah, you can eat them. And
but aren't they sort of prickly?
Actually, once the rose hips themselves, no, only the little top part of this particular variety that we have.
Mm-hmm.
I think the dog started chewing on one and inspired everybody else to try it.
And then I think Kalmia with the mountain laurel is getting a little more popular.
Mm-hmm. Those are again the tissue culture revolution of
right.
of Richard Janes in Connecticut, right. Southwestern Connecticut, has hybridized and collected for probably 50 years. It's his hobby, and he has a wonderful nursery in Connecticut, and he had something like 350 different kinds of kalmias, and he got together with Bruce Briggs in Olympia, Washington, that did the tissue culture, and so they're actually available. That 30 years ago, you would never see a mountain laurel. I mean, you'd see a seedling,
right.
or in the Northeast, you'd see wild collected plants. But there's these amazing ones with pink flowers or the spotted bands around the flowers or white or all kinds of different things, and they do them from tissue culture in the lab.
Mm-hmm. Roger, Sarcococca or the sweet box, this seems to be a plant that, you know, again, it's been around for a while, but nobody really uses it,
mm-hmm.
but becoming more available.
Mm-hmm.
Great value in terms of bloom and foliage. Kind of the Elysium sort of reminded me of that, a sweet box sort of
mm-hmm.
appeal.
Well, it's for us, it blooms in January and February,
uh-huh.
when it's fairly quiet and the fragrance is wonderful. It makes a thick, full ground cover. It's been used here for a long, long time and stays low and compact and very disease resistant, and it can take a lot of shade.
So what do you stick under just plain fun?
Oh, things the Pancyrus flying dragon.
Oh, yeah.
It's the hardy citrus and the
right.
and the species, excuse me, the species is just a straight small tree, large shrub with straight thorns, and the flying dragon is contorted. And everything is contorted, the fruit, the flowers, the foliage, the stems, even the roots are contorted.
Wow.
Even the owners, I think.
Yeah. And the thorns are about 2.5 inches long, these hard green thorns.
Yeah.
Very few leaves, but it makes a really neat container plant and unbelievably hardy.
Hmm.
Yeah. Now, if you had to pick just one plant now that you'd like to promote that nobody's using and should be, what would it be?
Oh, that's too hard. One of the ones that people still aren't using as much as I think they should is the fringe tree, Chionanthus virginicus.
Right.
And it's another American native, extraordinary plant for a lot of the different parts of the country. And it's been around, again, around here for probably 50 years. But mm-hmm. it was just in a few select gardens until they finally got people started doing seed.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's a little more available. But it blooms for us in about mid-June for about 3 weeks. Very fragrant white flowers. They're sort of like cut silk of just, you've taken pinking shears to all the flowers. And it blooms just ahead of the foliage coming out.
Right.
So it makes a really nice display. And then the female plants will have olive fruit on them. It's essentially a hardy olive.
Well, Raj, thanks. It's always good to talk to you, and congratulations on the book. And it really is a worthwhile tool for people looking for some different, hardy, unusual shrubs that will do very well here in the Louisville area.
Well, thanks for calling. It's been fun talking to you.
Good deal. Roger Gosler is part of a family nursery business that's been in operation in Oregon for more than 40 years. He's also co-author of the book, The Gosler Guide to the Best Hardy Shrubs, more than 350 expert choices for your garden. For more information on their mail order nursery or the book, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org.
Coming up next, arborist and tree climbing champion Josephine Hedger joins us in the studio. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL. Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
With Bob Hill.
And I have to say that I'm very excited about this, and I have to make a confession, Bob.
Let me get a violin out here. I checked out
YouTube for the very first time in my entire life.
Oh, no.
So that I could see our next guest do a secure foot lock at 15.7 seconds record time up a 33-foot ascent into an oak tree.
So secure footlock means you're climbing a rope as fast as you can.
You know, I have the visual of it, and I think Josephine will be able to explain it in more detail, but I'm pretty sure neither one of us could do it.
My college days, I climbed a rope in, like, I think it was 4 hours.
Okay.
No problem.
And not very far, perhaps.
No, I was up 15, 20 feet. I was scared to death. My instructor scared me, so he said, get up there, and I did. I don't know how I did.
You best forgot, right? Yeah,
enough about me. We've got Josephine here.
That's right. Josephine Hedger is joining us in the studio right now. She's an arborist and champion tree climber from Sway, Hampshire in England. She's on her way to the Charlotte Tree Climbing Competition in North Carolina, but she stopped in Louisville to visit with some of our local expert tree climbers at Limwalker, and I'd like to thank them for hooking me up with her and hosting her here. But Josephine, thank you for coming into the studio. We appreciate it. Welcome.
Hello.
I have to ask, because you're relatively young, mid-20s, what drew you to being an arborist, and more specifically to being one that has an emphasis on tree climbing?
It's not seen as an industry where a lot of females are involved in it. I don't know why. I suppose it's just a stereotypical thing. But I got involved in it because I started doing landscaping, enjoyed working outside, loved that side of it, but needed something a little bit more challenging. the thing I love about tree work is every day is different. You learn something every single day, and that side of it drew it to me.
So where do you start? Do you know what I mean? Are there training? Do you find a mentor? Part of a company that has the same expertise, classes?
Yeah, I mean, there's lots of different ways you could go get into the industry. The way I did it back home in England, I had an interest. I had a friend that was a tree climber, and we just went recreational climbing. Mm-hmm. So I found that, A, I wasn't scared of heights, and obviously enjoyed it.
Right.
And then you can either go and work for a local tree care company who will obviously help train you and get you up to speed. But in England, we have training colleges, so a land-based college where we can go and maybe just do a short course or a year or two-year course. So I did a one-year course, got all the basics, which will allow you to go into the industry to work and then obviously get lots of experience.
You mentioned recreational. Was that recreational tree climbing? That sounds like fun.
Yeah.
Where'd you go and how'd you do it?
Well, I was fortunate. I had a friend who was a tree surgeon at the time, who obviously had some spare kit, and we climbed together. I don't know what it's like here in America for recreational tree climbing. I hear it's quite big, quite popular.
Yeah, I'd never heard of it here. As a kid, I climbed trees as much as I could, but to go out like climbing a cliff or scaling, it sounds like a lot of fun. Would you find like monster trees, 100 feet, 150 feet, and go to the top?
Oh, yeah. No, that's the
idea.
Yeah, that's the beauty
that's what
of
I mean,
it.
Yeah.
That's the exciting side of it. You know, you can you can climb a small squat tree and rather get high, but you're going out along the limbs.
Yeah.
So, you know, you've got that side of it, but also you've got big, massive trees, something like a redwood where you might be 120 foot or up a big pine or something. So it's the height side of it. So
wow. That sounds like fun.
You know, but ultimately, at least in this conversation, it's about training yourself well so you can do a job, you know, where safety and equipment and all of that's a part of it. And, you know, if you can you give us a little bit of an idea of what would be going through your mind and what you would have to consider and be ready for when you showed up for a job and had to, you know, fell a tree or thin a canopy of a 90-foot tree?
Well, the it depends. If you obviously haven't seen the job previously, so you're just there as a contract climber, for example, you've come in and you've got a job spec. Obviously, the first thing is to find out what it is you've actually got to do to the trees. Work out a game plan with your co-workers, because that's the biggest thing. It's not just a one-person job. You've got to work. Your climber is only as good as your groundsman, and obviously vice versa. Your groundsmen aren't going to be any good if your climber's not communicating with you. And find out the safest, easiest way of doing it. And also what's physically easiest on our bodies, because you don't want to take lots of small pieces out and have to constantly lift stuff. So if you can use ropes and rigging to try and reduce the amount of physical stuff on our bodies, then obviously that helps. you may do something quite simple where you would throw up into the canopy wherever you can in the branches, and basically access branch to branch until you could get to the top of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
As you become more experienced, you used what we call like a small throw line. It's a very small, thin cord with a lead-weighted bag on the end. So rather than try to throw a rope up, you would throw that, and you can accurately get that into forks, mm-hmm. anything so 70, 80 foot up,
mm-hmm.
Which most of the time is near the top of the tree.
Mm-hmm.
And then once you've got that in, put your access line in, and then you can choose a number of different techniques. So, for example, like you were talking about the secured footlock, you mm-hmm. can use that technique. You can use a single rope where you use a lot of cammed ascenders, very mm-hmm. similar from rock climbing.
Like rappelling.
Yeah.
Give our listeners an idea of what a secure footlock entails.
Okay, well, basically what it is, the rope has gone up over a branch and has come back down to you, so you've got two bits of rope in front of you.
Mm-hmm.
And then, obviously, to make sure that we're safe the whole time, we have a harness on, and we're attached to that rope with another short piece of cord,
mm-hmm.
or hitch cord, which we tie on there in such a way that if we were to let go of the ropes, that would lock off and we're obviously safe.
Mm-hmm.
And then the actual technique is basically you don't load that knot at any point if you can avoid it. So you're physically climbing the rope. So what you tend to do is you hold both hands behind the rope, or both ropes, and you basically hold the rope with your arms or your hands,
mm-hmm.
and then you bring your feet up and your foot scoops up both ropes, and then you stand on your other foot.
Okay.
So you're actually trying
free
to...
put a little bit of a step for
yeah,
you.
Yeah, so you're actually going to try and clamp it down on your own foot.
Uh-huh.
That then allowed you to stand up, slide the knot up, and then uh-huh. do it all again.
It's amazing. In terms of women moving into the field, are you starting to notice that more and more women are getting into the field? And when I mean more specifically the tree climbing component to the arborist work that you do,
okay.
you know, are the doors opening, do you think?
Yeah, it's definitely, I mean, I've only been doing the competitions coming up to about 5 years now. And when I first started, there was a very small amount of females that did it. And definitely in the last couple of years, especially from going to the international competitions, the numbers are increasing each year. So, you know, it's obviously showing that females are getting mm-hmm. into it and staying in it as well.
Yeah. Is there like a profile, do you think, of someone who this is the perfect sort of job track for them?
Yes and no. Obviously, mm-hmm. you've got to be physically fit. But it's not all about strength. It's a sort of a myth that people say, oh, you've got to have a lot of upper body strength. But you don't have to. It's all to do with technique. If you look at a lot of guys that do tree work, you'll get some small guys that are very good for doing pruning and getting around the tree. Then you'll get some guys that are sort of big and heavy, but mm-hmm. they're good for dismantling, but can't maybe do the small light stuff. So mm-hmm. it's the same from a female point of view. There's a mixture of jobs available to suit everybody. And you've also mentally got to have, I think, a good attitude to it. Don't go into it thinking this is a male environment and I'm a female. Mm-hmm. Just go into it as an everyday job.
I'm a tree climber.
I'm a tree climber. And, you know, I'll try and do what I can and obviously progress.
Let's talk about the competitions you compete with. How does that work?
Well, the actual structure of the competition.
Yeah.
Well, basically, it's divided up into normally 2 days. So the first day will be divided up into 5 different events. And those 5 different events will be a mixture of speed, ability, knowledge, and skill. And you basically get scored on those and accumulate points. Those points then allow you to go forward. And if you are, let's say, the 3rd or the 5th highest placed person, they will put you into the final, which is on the 2nd day.
Mm-hmm.
And the final is a mixture of all the techniques and skills that you have to display. And it's basically your own choice of how you display those.
Okay. So, unfortunately, it's not your world record anymore.
No, it's gone.
But in, 2008, Josephine, you held the world record at 15.7 seconds?
Yeah, for a 40-foot footlock. So
okay.
That secured footlock I was talking about. It's 40 foot, and it's basically the quickest person to the top.
Okay.
And it was in 2008. The record previously, I think, was something like 17.4.
Mm-hmm.
I think off the top of my head. And then I got that down to 15.7 seconds.
Mm-hmm.
And then just recently, it's gone down to 15.1 by a New Zealand girl.
Uh-huh. So at these competitions, because we were talking about how there's like local levels, state level, national level, international levels, and you've participated in all of those. But are they mostly the industry that's there as the audience and watching, or do you get people coming to watch? Because it is entertaining, because it's a very athletic, agile, interesting thing to watch people do this work.
Yeah, it's definitely an interesting sport, so to speak, to watch if you've never seen it before. As far as the competitors go, yes, most of them will be in the arboricultural side of it anyway. As far as spectators go, it really depends on the competition. Okay. Obviously, if it's quite a small competition that hasn't maybe got a lot of sponsorship or coverage.
Mm-hmm. It's just you all.
It's just going to be us cheering everybody else on, maybe a few family members or friends. But as the competition gets larger or there's more sponsorship and coverage, and the location always helps. So if you're in the middle of a park in a city, for example, yeah, you definitely then get a lot more people coming over. And it's always surprising to people as well how interesting the sport is. You know, I think when you talk to people generally about a tree climbing competition, they presume it's the spiking where you spike up a pole or you're doing something
with
timber.
Which is not what an arborist would do to a tree. Yeah.
No, exactly. You know, more to do with safety and the movement around the tree. So, yeah, I think it's definitely a surprise to people, but it's definitely a way of trying to promote the industry as such.
Right. I was thinking that, too, just to promote what you guys really do, what your expertise really is, which is tree care.
Yeah.
Because you see the logger shows you're mentioning on TV, and it's a whole different thing they're doing. They're cutting down trees and hauling them off for timber and stuff. Yeah, and this is a different thing. Is there a world championship somewhere where the best of the best meet for one final, this is as good as it gets competition?
No, that would just be the international competition. So we'll have a chapter, and the chapter will have a competition where their best climber will go forward to maybe the European. We have a European competition or the Asia-Pacific competition, and then the main competition where every chapter or country's better climbers then go to the international. So, yeah, that would be where they will gather.
Okay. They kind of weed you out along the way. So you've made it all the way to the international competition. Where is it going to be this year?
This year is in Chicago.
Okay. So perhaps the thread that holds all of this together is the International Society of Arboriculture, because don't they generally make the rules for everyone worldwide? I mean, is that how this can become such a international?
Yeah, for as far as the competition side of it goes, yes, the rules, basically the rule book, whether you go to Australia or Germany, Italy,
it's the same.
Anywhere in America, the rule book is the same.
Okay.
Is there any monetary gain in this, or any stars that make more money than anybody else just for showing up?
No, unfortunately not. No, not really. I mean, obviously you'll get, depending on the competition, there's sponsorship, so... Yeah.
They give you some bling.
You'll probably win a rope or a check or something, but it's nothing major. And no, not that I'm aware of that anyone gets any guest appearances.
That'll be real progress, right, if we see you on a Wheaties box or something.
Well, what's a typical first prize check?
Oh, I don't know. Depends really on the sponsorship. Okay. But I mean, the main finals, you may get £100, so maybe so like $200 to $500 maybe maximum.
Right.
Won't even cover your travel expenses.
No, that's the trouble. If you go into this thinking, you know, I've got to win this to allow me to pay for my hotel and my travel, then you're going to go back quite unhappy, because you're not, even if you win, you're doing it for the love of it rather than the money side of it.
Yeah. So you have your own company in England, Arbor Venture.
That's right.
So you go out and do jobs like anybody else would here. But then you also do training, is that?
Yeah, that's correct. In England, as far as we're concerned, when somebody has to work in this arboriculture field, they have to legally hold certificates of competence. And we've got a national recognised qualification for that. So we run a training provider company for that. So people, it's basically like a college, really. People come to us for short courses. We train them. We assess them, make sure they're at the correct standard. If they're not, they have to go back for more training or obviously pass, and then they can go on to work. So, yeah, we run a training company for anything to do with tree climbing or forestry. And sidelining with that sort of doubled up is the actual tree care side of it.
Okay, sounds good.
Wonderful.
It is. Well, good luck
absolutely.
In Charlotte and have fun. I hear that this one's a little bit more of a fun, low-pressure competition.
Don't break a leg either.
Yeah, break a leg. And have fun, and we appreciate you coming in very much. Really interesting.
Okay, great. Thank you.
Thank you. Josephine Hedger is an arborist from Sway, Hampshire, England, where she does secured footlocks, climbing, rappelling, and rigging every day for work. But she's also an international tree climbing champion. She did hold the world record for climbing 33 feet up using a rope and secured footlock technique, all in 15.7 seconds. And of course, for more information on Josephine and the International Society of Arboriculture and their tree climbing championships, please go to our website at wfpl.org.
Coming up next, a few listener questions and another chapter in Bob's Fabulous Plant Stories. You're listening to Homegrown on 89.3 WFPL.
Why do you whisper green grass? Why tell the trees what ain't so? Whispering grass, the trees don't have to know. No, no. Why tell them all your secrets? Who kissed there long ago? Whispering grass, don't tell the trees, 'cause the trees don't need to know.
Welcome back to Homegrown. I'm Janine Wishy.
Bob Hill, we got two and a half to three pretty good questions.
Two and a half to three.
Two and a half to three, somewhere in there.
All right, this one's from Anne, and it's got you written all over it, Bob Hill. How about that? The bark of my dogwood tree is breaking away in a section just below where a limb broke last year due to the ice storm.
Right.
What action, if any, should I take? The tree bloomed beautifully this year, even in the area above where the bark is breaking away.
Oddly enough, we just had a tree trimmer on the show.
We did indeed.
So it helps a whole lot. Obviously, if this limb is jagged or broken, it needs to be cut off at the shoulder, cleanly at the shoulder. And that's what you have to do. And then from there on out, the tree will often take care of itself. If the bark's breaking away below it, it may or may not come back. But if you cut the limb off neatly, I think it'll solve the problem, the immediate problem.
Yeah.
And you won't have, it'll heal itself there, and then we'll see what happens. But they're pretty tough trees.
Usually a tree can compartmentalize its wound.
Right, exactly.
And this is the time of the year that it will do that. So it just, you need to clean up all the tissue beyond that. That's what Bob's talking about with trimming it at the branch collar.
Right.
And just be patient and see what happens. Yeah. You don't want to wrap it. You don't want to paint anything on it. You just want the tree to sort of heal over on itself.
And dogwood bark can kind of break away a little bit anyway. I mean, it can be a little scaly at times anyway. So I don't think it's going to be a crisis situation.
No. All right. If the tree's healthy.
Yeah.
Another question from Anne. I recently received a pawpaw tree as a free giveaway. Can you tell me how large the canopy will be? It is less than a foot tall right now.
Well,
she plants it in an area for now where it's protected from possibly people tripping over it. But once it gets 3 to 4 feet tall, she does want to move it to a more open area.
Yeah, my pawpaw is about, and my mama, my pawpaw is about 20 feet tall, maybe 15, 18 feet across, kind of a nice canopy to it.
Mm-hmm.
And I actually get pawpaws, but you need a male and a female. If she's thinking that she may get pawpaws out of this thing, it may not happen.
Mm-hmm.
And moving it again could be a little difficult. They don't like to be moved. They're native trees, and she wants to get it 3 to 4 feet and move it again. That could be iffy.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not sure I'd want to do that with a pawpaw.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Some trees are perfectly fine being relocated. Some trees just simply don't do it well.
Not pawpaws.
And that's one of them.
Yeah, for sure.
So go find a nice big open area right now.
Yep.
And then just put a
fence around it.
Put a tomato cage around it.
And I hope you get pawpaws in there. They're just fun to have, so I hope she gets some in the near
future.
Maybe
somebody has one in the neighborhood.
Yeah, you never know.
All right, one more question.
This is for Janine from Deborah. What is the most environmentally responsible type of mulch to use, and how can I get it delivered?
Environmentally responsible, I got to wonder exactly what she means by that.
Yeah.
So most multi-materials is going to be trucked in from somewhere, unless you had a tree chipped in your backyard and you're using that,
or a pickup truck or something.
But even like the stuff that you buy in bulk got trucked in from somewhere. So environmentally friendly, I'm going to take as, you know, what's best for your plants. And quite frankly, the chunkier or the coarser the mulch, the better. Hardwood mulch, that's fine. It gets hydrophobic and sort of, you know, crusts over sometimes.
Yeah.
So you don't get the water penetration nor the oxygen penetration that you're going to get with pine straw or those big, the chunkier pieces of mulch. My personal favorite is pine straw because it does everything it's supposed to do as a mulch, controls weeds, you know, moderates soil temperature and moisture, and it looks nice, right? But it also allows for that penetration that I'm talking about. So I would look for pine straw. And quite frankly, most garden centers have delivery capability. So if you say, I need this much mulch, they'll deliver it to you if you can't quite manage to pick it up or haul it away in your trunk. So you just need to call your local garden centers and see what's available.
If you have an environmentally friendly question for Bob or Janine, visit the Homegrown page at WFPL.org, email us at homegrown@WFPL.org, or call us at 814-8246.
All right, Bob, it's a plant story day. What do you have?
I had you in mind, kiddo.
All right.
This one might be one you grow and eat.
Okay.
Also, it kind of matches. We did a show a couple weeks ago on roots.
Mm-hmm.
The plant is the rutabaga.
Root. I love rutabaga, but I don't grow them.
Oh, no.
Huh.
Yeah,
maybe
I
should.
Yeah, you should. It's an odd duck in the food pond. It's it's a root vegetable. It's a cross between a wild cabbage and a turnip.
Is that what it is?
Yeah.
Huh?
Yeah. Its leaves can be eaten, but it kind of looks like a turnip with a yellow-orange flesh and kind of ridges at the neck. Something else you should know. The word rutabaga comes from the Swedish rutbagi, which means root ram.
Root ram.
But in England, Wales, Australia, and New Zealand, it's called, perhaps a little pejoratively, the Swede.
Oh, really?
Yes.
That's funny.
Because it was first found in the early 1600s growing in
Sweden.
You got it.
The Swedes like white foods that store well through the winter.
Yeah, rutabaga of Swede. Give me a bucket of Swede here.
That's funny.
Yeah, it's sort of a happy historical horticultural accident. The wild cabbage and the turnip just mated somewhere. Video is available somewhere. The Latin, of course, is Brassica naprobrassica, but you knew that. Very easy to grow, but it gets real tough in hot weather, so you got to get it when it's cool. Hence the Nordic countries love it so much.
So.
But it had a great usage. It's fed by the ton to livestock, and in the darker days of World War I and World War II, it kept people alive.
Yeah.
They just had a lot around. Ireland first used it as a jack-o'-lantern.
I knew that from old Halloween stories. Yeah,
it's a good stuff. It's rich in keratin and vitamin A and C.
Mm-hmm.
And rutabaga is not totally ignored. Cumberland, Wisconsin has the Rutabaga Festival every year in August. More funny.
Because there's Nordic people that live up there.
this is really funny. Given the recent buzz and curling at the Olympics.
Yeah.
There's an international rutabaga curl in the winter at Ithaca Farmers Market in Ithaca, New York.
That sounds like a lot of sense.
Because in 1996, it was a cold, slow day.
Mm-hmm.
Vendors began hurling rutabagas, cabbage, potatoes, loaves of bread, and even frozen chickens down the wooden floor.
And they found the rutabaga was the best.
Yeah, and it was a contest here somewhere. So in 1998, they codified the rules. Now they have an annual rutabaga curl right there in little Ithaca.
Excellent.
Comes with a poem.
All right.
Consider, please, the possible emotional baggage when wild turnips fall for the lovely cabbage. One thrives below ground, away from all eyes. The other above ground with the worms and flies. How was it possible that the two got together? Was it a warm spring day? Can we just blame the weather? How do you have something like love at first sight when one plant grows down and the other seeks light? Yet it's foolish to question Mother Nature's grand plan. The very best we can do is the very best that we can. And much the same must be said of love's foolish flings when wild cabbage and turnips don gossamer wings.
The Swede.
I like it. The Swede.
More reason to grow it.
A boinga, boinga, boinga.
All right. I'm on. I'll get on that. Maybe for a fall crop.
So bring it in with poke salad and brassica.
Yeah, that's right. I still need to make you poke. It is starting to come up, and now's the time to harvest the poke before it gets old.
I'm prepared.
You're on.
Grab my neck and fall over.
Eggs and poke. All right. Well, that ends another edition of Homegrown next week on the show. A garden at the Louisville Deaf and Oral School and the Olmsted Conservancy's plans to raise money, eradicate invasive weeds, and perpetuate the beauty of the parks.
Homegrown is produced by the solidly rooted Brad Yost in the studios of WFPL. I'm Bob Hill.
And I'm Janine Wishy. Join us next week for Homegrown on WFPL.